Hello everyone and welcome to Inside the Arena podcast, brought to you by Piers Arena. On Inside the Arena podcast, we talk about mental health, well-being, and every other issues and challenges we all face in our day-to-day lives. And on each episode, we'll be having a guest on to talk about their own experience with these issues, and most importantly, how they are able to navigate and overcome life struggles and challenges. I am your host, Tony, and thank you very much for listening. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Inside the Arena podcast. In today's episode, we'll be diving into the emotional landscape of grief that accompanies the loss of physical health or ability, a topic that affects countless of individuals in Nigeria, yet is often overlooked or in most cases misunderstood. Today, we are joined by two remarkable guests who will bring their unique perspective and expertise to the table. First, we have Adenike, a courageous individual who experienced the loss of one of her legs. She will share her personal journey of navigating the emotional challenges that came with such profound change. And to provide us with the clinical insight and guidance, we have the honor of having Anu Jideojo, a renowned clinical psychologist and the founder of Us Therapy. Anu's expertise will shed light on the psychological aspect of grieving, physical health or ability, and offer practical insights and strategies overcoming these challenges. Our goal is to create a safe and supportive space for you, our listeners, where you can find inspiration, guidance, and practical advice. We hope that by sharing these stories and insights, we can help you embrace resilience and navigate life after loss. So whether you're personally affected by the loss of physical health or ability, or seeking a deeper understanding of the human experience, this episode is definitely for you. I'm thrilled to embark on this profound conversation with our incredible guest. And without wasting so much of our time, let's jump right into it. So I would like to go first with Adenike. Please introduce yourself so the audience can get a sense of who you are and get a sense of the conversation we'll be having today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a great opportunity. You were patient enough, and I do not take the opportunity for granted. My name, like you stated earlier, is Adenike. I am the daughter of Oyetunde and wife to Lawal. I am a person with disability in Lagos, Nigeria, having acquired disability in my 20th year while in my second year university studying law. I have moved on from there, finished and done quite a number of things. But most importantly, I am a light carrier. I am one whose life has been spurred upside down, inside out, but still continues to push through because of the power of one, God, resilience, and most importantly, gratitude. I see gratitude change my perspective about everything in life, including grief loss. Grief, loss, limb loss, as well as life living in Nigeria as a Nigerian. I love to read books a whole lot, though this year has been very funny about my book reading. I love children a lot. I love to watch documentaries. I love to read autobiographies. So anything that has to do with, you know, an adaptation of a book into a novel or telling a story from real life, you will find me there. And what else? I recently learned, I'm learning how to swim, so that is keeping me busy. I recently got 2 extra tattoos. So yeah, I think that's on my CZ. And I'm a child of God, most importantly. So thank you again for having me.
Yeah, thank you very, very much for taking the time. Anu, please, do you mind introducing yourself?
Okay, hi everyone. My name is Anu Jideojo, and I'm a clinical psychologist and the lead psychotherapist at Us Therapy. At Us Therapy, the goal is to help people navigate their mental health journey and move from experiencing the world, how they perceive themselves and other people, from a lens of shame to experiencing the world from a lens of self-compassion, and build the skills to be like more functional and move closer to their values. I'm also the author of Messily Living, a therapy journal that was created to help your therapy journey a lot more meaningful and less daunting and overwhelming. I'm very excited to have this conversation with Adenike. I've like experienced your story from afar, and I'm so glad to have you on here. And of course, hi Tony. happy to continue our conversation on grief. It has been remarkable so far. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I truly, truly appreciate it. And I really do not take this for granted. And I'm really hoping that our conversation today resonates with a lot of people and help people find some sort of closure from this conversation. So I think we should just dive right in. I would like to start with Adenike specifically. I did a lot of research and listened to a lot of your interviews, and the one you did with Temisen, the tea with Tay, was one that was very, very emotional. Yeah, because it was, but one of the things I took from it is, when you were, using the opportunity to educate him and educate the listeners about how to address people with disabilities, and we should always see the person first before seeing the disability. I think that was very, very profound. That's something I'm still learning myself. And I think it's something we all need to learn as a society. And with that in mind, my first question is, I would like you to share your story before, this became your reality. Who were you? What were your hopes? What were your aspirations? And who was Adenike before she turned 20?
This picture is in my study. This picture was taken, I think, in my first or second year university. And almost all my friends that we went to school together, majority of them that we were close, you know, have me to thank for quite a number of the pictures that they took in their undergrad. And that just amazes who it was, or who it is that I was back then, and I still am. I didn't know, and I couldn't encapsulate it in words, that I was the seize the moment, live in the moment, be present, freeze time person. Up until, you know, in hindsight, I started to look at my life and I say, oh, this is who I've always been. I'm 37. And for almost every year, for several years, I've always had a photo shoot. And people would ask me, but it's not a milestone birthday. I'm like, just smile. And I've saved, you know, without taking away from the essence of who takes my pictures, my dearest, dearest, dearest friend. And I'll say to people who are close to me that, oh, I know what it is worth if I was paying fully for this service. But because I have a connect with this person, and this person, I said, and but besides, and most importantly, every single birthday to me is a milestone. At the age of 20, being told that you have cancer and being told that the only way out is an amputation, I promise you that every single day counts. Every single birthday is a milestone. I do not pray for a recurrence, to be honest, and to the glory of God, from 20th year up until now, 17 years later, I have remained cancer-free. Have I had scares here and there? Absolutely. Have I had the worries here and there? Definitely. And that's because there are many life changes and lifestyle changes that impact a person's life once you have been diagnosed with cancer. And I didn't know all of this. You know, I didn't know that cancer meant my body is inflamed. I didn't know that my cancer meant my body is fighting itself. So no one spoke to me about nutrition. No one spoke to me about all of that. So, you know, imagine years later now finding out that, I had to undergo a myomectomy, a fibroids removal. I'm like, wait a minute. These things are all connected. Because if my body was inflamed at the time, it was inflamed with cancer. Now, years later, it means that I must be very cautious about what it is that I put into my mouth. Do I do it all the time? No. But do I try my best to do it as often as I can? Absolutely, yes. So who Adenike was, you know, when she was 20, and who Adenike is now that she's 37, hasn't really changed much, to be honest. But what has now changed is the context of the life that I live now. One, through nutrition, through lifestyle changes, through paying attention to people and the things that, you know, demand and deserve my time, through where and who I spend my time with, through what it is that I ruminate on, and that entails and is not limited to social media, to movies, to, you know, books, to articles, to even conversations. And it hasn't changed much. Adenike was rarely ever used to sit down in one place. I was always gallivanting. Yes, I'm not gallivanting to the places that I wish I could, like Lagos Market, Balogun, Yaba, and all of that. But guess what? I am still moving to the places that I want to move to in the way that I can move and in the pace that I can move. And not much has changed, to be candid with you, from the diagnosis 17 years ago to who it is I am now. And I suspect who it is I'll become in the nearest future. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing that. Just brings a lot of perspective into the same thing about addressing people or seeing the person first and understanding people have their story, life circumstances before whatever happened to them. And we should always remember to think of it from that perspective, because we are all people. And I think I've heard you said this so many times, like, we are just one step away from any sort of disabilities in our life. So we should always consider that. When faced with life-altering changes like this, it is natural for people to experience a lot of emotions. Can you share the specific moments where you encountered this emotional landscape and how you were able to really overcome it? Like, what was your initial reaction when it became obvious that the amputation needed to happen? And what was your reaction to that?
Oh, wow. So because my from my diagnosis to moving around to now finding myself at UCH and then I finally admitting that I needed to really have an amputation took a period of time. For me, it didn't hit me as everybody might expect, because at that point it became a question of relief. Can you take this thing off of me so that I can be pain free? I can even just leave. Can you take this thing off of me so that I have the very next day? At that point, I don't know where I got the power, the gumption form, but I was very certain that I wasn't going to die. So even if I had had that leg attached to me for months, even following my first diagnosis, I knew that all that would be lost would be the limb and not my life. I was so resolute about it. You know, I was so certain that there was no question of death, to be candid. And sometimes I find myself, you know, in challenges now, and I'm like, God, if only I would have a quarter of the faith and the belief I had back then. Because I was so dogged, and I was like, you know what, what's going to happen is they're just going to take this leg off. So it wasn't I got to this moment and I knew that, you know, there was an epiphany. I just knew that I was dying. I knew that life was leaving me. I knew that I was in constant pain 24/7. I couldn't sleep. In 24 hours, I'd only be able to sleep maybe 2 or 3 hours under medication, by the way, strong medication. So I got to the point where as soon as I got into UCH and the medical director, the orthopedic surgeon cited me. The first thing he said was, young lady, this is an orthopedic emergency and you must cut this leg immediately. So there was no room for me to, sir, are you sure? Are you sure this is what you do? They said that if you Nigerian doctors, the ones who don't know what they want to do, they'll tell you to cut it. So it was that whole drag that made my own journey very instructive, so much so that I just wanted to fight to live. I wanted to fight for my life. And I think that maybe I got into the acceptance stage in those moments, but primarily that is what, you know, my memory is replaying back, the recollection of events. And that's exactly what it is that happened. So much so that the very next day after the amputation, I was ready to get out of the bed. I was just ready, like, you guys, this thing has been delaying me. Where do we go? Where do we go? How do we go? And because I had never walked with crutches with one leg, you know, my doctors and the nurses had to say, Auntie, calm down. Why are you in a hurry? You know, I hadn't had to slow my brain down. In my opinion now, with the knowledge that I have, I believe that it might have just been some burst of adrenaline telling my body, my brain, you know, this thing has been cut off. Because ideally you are born and you're supposed to have all four limbs. So now that there's an obstruction somewhere, my suspicion is that there was an outburst of adrenaline or dopamine in my brain and said, stand up, do this thing. What's going on? Your body is being shocked, you know, shot into a shock mode. But I just wanted to be alive. I just wanted to be fine. I just wanted to see that I was not in pain. I was tired of taking medication orally and intravenously. I remember crying to my father to say, I am tired. And the moment the solution was an amputation, I'm like, let's do this. I didn't think about the future. I didn't have 1 year plan. I didn't have 1 week plan. I didn't have 1 month plan. All I had was the very next day. Just let me see the next day without this cancer. And that, I believe very strongly, that's my answer to your question.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think I would like to bring Anu into this place specifically. Anu, can you speak to the psychology of finding relief in the midst of such pain, agony, and even if it's something that's that somebody has full awareness of, that this might actually alter my identity in some way, but you feel that relief inside of you to say, okay, I'll let this happen. Can you speak to that?
Okay. I think that with certain illnesses and the person's experience of the illness, relief may come immediately where, okay, this amputation means pain is gone, right? The person has mentally prepared for it. The meaning that they are making from it is that this is a good thing, or it's a healthy thing to go. It's good for me. And when you compare both, either this amputation or death, I would choose this amputation. Is either this amputation or consistent pain or chronic pain, I would choose it. Then it's creating like a way out or a lease on life. So in that sense, I imagine how relief will be like the way to go. It will be like the primary emotion that the person will feel in that instance. And I think relief comes a lot of times when the person has like sat with the situation and the meaning that they have created for me. It means like, okay, this is the way to go. This is good for me. And they've made meaning from it. It's not like, oh, something is being taken away, or even if there is the aspect of something being taken away, it's like what is being left behind is still good enough compared to a situation where it's just like you were on your way out and then you went into an accident and it's like we need to cut your foot now, or you need to do this now, and it's like you've not come to terms with it. It's like there's no sitting down, there's no processing. And in that moment, I don't think that relief might be the immediate way to go, even if you're in excruciating pain. So it depends on like the situation that the person is experiencing. But I imagine like when you've had the moment to make meaning out of the situation, then relief may be one of the takeaways that you would have because you have processed it. And like I don't know if I'll phrase it as a gift, but it feels like a gift in that moment. Yeah.
I think I completely agree with that, because going back to her conversation with Temisen, she said the first time she was told that they might have to amputate the knee, actually, she was like, you're not talking to me, because that was the instant moment, right? Like she was like, no, this, you're not talking to me. And she was even more focused on her dad at that particular point. Like, I'd really encourage people to go listen to that episode. It's truly, truly remarkable. But I think just, taking the things I heard from that and as in like cross-checking it with what you've said right now, it makes a whole lot of sense. Is that something you can speak to Adenike also?
You know, listening to her say that it's a gift kind of makes me put certain things in circumspect, where through the years, I'm not trying in any way to convince anyone, but I'm just expressing what my journey is like, and people are unable to connect, knowing full well that in my own instance, I identify with their stage, where they are and how they got to where they got to. But on the other hand, they struggle with the reality that, you mean this did not happen to you? You mean you did not react this way? And it just might be a gift, to be candid with you, because again, you see that when you engage with several, you know, levels of people across different social strata or economic strata, you see that this is commonplace. And that's not saying I haven't met people like myself. I have even met people with a higher frequency, and I'm like, wait, you are clearly not human. You are either superhuman, or for people who believe in God, you definitely are an angel. You're an angel having a human experience. I see it now as truly, truly, it's a gift. And it just makes me feel very special. Like, okay, at the end of today, my gratitude journal, I'm going to say, oh, wow, God, you know, I never knew that this thing that you gave me is the gift to navigate through challenges. Because I'll be candid with you, when I recount even present challenges to people, you know, one of my friend's first response was, how are you still living? How are you still alive? And I'm like, hey, is that bad? So yeah, I think I really do have a gift. And thank you, Anu, for point that really hit me. I'm like, thank you very much for pointing it out. Processing many things, you know, differs from person to person. And again, I believe as individuals, we are a culmination of everything that we have experienced, who we are, the environment we live in, the kind of people that we associate with. At the point when this journey started, by the way, I'm an only child. I didn't have a sibling where I could have said, oh, my brother or my sister or my cousin who was living with us is a born pessimist. I'm optimistic by nature, but life is, you know, trying to draw out pessimism from me every now and then. But I'm optimistic by nature, and I see that my father also carries that measure of optimism. However, my mom is pessimistic, and when this journey happened, the very first person who was optimistic was my mom. I couldn't believe it. She was the first one that said, look, you guys, if they're saying this and it's going to preserve her life, how about we listen to them? So again, I believe very strongly that no matter what it is that you have experienced or you are experiencing and who you are with, I believe very strongly that the environment that you grew up in, the environment you're currently staying in, and the people that you surround yourself with play a huge role in how you process the grief, the loss. Because had you told me it was going to be a tiny finger, this small one, I'd have taken 3 months to think about it. And there I was, from the very first time they told me I had to amputate, time had passed, to the very next time I was told, young lady, you have to take it out, I did not haggle, because life had passed through me and I was seeing myself die. And I was able, through all of those weeks and months, to process that. Alaye, if you don't cut this thing, no. Only God knows where it will lead to. So yes, I agree with you. The gifting as well as the people and the environment that I was surrounded with made the processing of the loss, I don't want to say easier, because down the line, what happened to me is that I think maybe 8-9 years later, the reality started to dawn on me that, okay, of a truth, you have one leg. It didn't. I wasn't denied of anything. I'll be candid with you. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, I have been vehemently denied of stuff because I have one leg. But have I been limited in terms of access? Absolutely. You know, fully bodied people don't even have full access to many things across the world. How much more people who live with different forms of disability, and in my own case, you know, physical disability where everybody sees it. So yeah, don't let me talk too much, because I can't talk.
Yeah, well, you're welcome to, actually. You're really welcome to. That's what this space is for. You said something previously that maybe it was the adrenaline, maybe it was the dopamine in your system just immediately after the surgery that was just pushing you to get up, you know, and do other things. And you also spoke about, like, a couple of weeks after that, when you started to realize that, okay, this is your reality and things like that. So I want you to, like, is there specific moments that you can describe where you actually realize, like, the true impact of losing your leg and the identity, the sense of identity that you now had?
Do I have a moment? No one comes to mind at the moment as I speak with you, I'll be honest. But do I have pockets of those reality checks? I do. And what do I mean by that? I mean, say, for instance, I meet children. Children are very perceptive. Children are very expressive. Children are wondrous humans. You know, and I'm standing and there's a child beside me, especially when I stop to wear my prosthetic limb, who is on the floor trying to look up to see where is her remaining leg. You know, in those moments, you know, it hits me again that this is an anomaly. This is not what they are used to. This is not what they are being taught. This is not what we expose them to directly, indirectly, consciously or subconsciously. And I think it's in those moments that reality of, hey, you have one leg. Say, for instance, I think the day I left the hospital, or the day after, I actually found myself in the car driving. I'm like, I was so ecstatic, like, you guys, I need to drive, because I started to drive when I was 16 and this happened when I was 20. And save for a fender bender I had, that was it. So I believe that those experiences made me realize that, hey, Alaye, though you have one leg, there are still a few things you'll be able to do. Nobody was able to strip away driving from me. I still drive very well, by the way. It took me a while before I started to make an attempt to learn how to swim until I resumed again actively this year. And I can swim. You know, I may not be able to swim professionally, but I can move from one end to the other. And basically, that is what swimming is. You know, and I don't have those one moments. It didn't impair me in the space of relationship where I would have said, oh, when I was dating this guy, because I was dating this guy, and I said, because I have one leg, oh, this is the end. In terms of my relationship, I had been in a relationship with someone. We had been having this back and forth, and I had said I wanted out. But I suspect that had I not taken time off school, we may have found a resolution around, okay, you know what, let's work around our issues. Save for that, when I got back to school from the whole post-cancer everything, in under a week, I was back into a new relationship with a person I had never met or never known before I lost my leg. And though that relationship didn't last so long, what it did to my mind is it really made me see that, look, you are still attractive, you are desirable, anyone can desire you. And those things affected me, I will be candid with you, because through the years I've sat down and I asked myself that, imagine nobody dated me then. Would it have affected me? I do not know. These are some of the moments where you never can say what could have happened until it really happened. When that relationship ended, I didn't date anybody for many years. Finished my undergrad, went to law school. I was not in a relationship up until I started work. And you know, there was a casuality with the relationship and blah, blah, blah. And that was it. So I don't feel like I had that one moment where, my God, one leg, what will my life be? And also don't forget that because I know a lot of people have started to introduce me to people who were living this life. I did not know anybody who was living that life. So the only person I reached out to who I knew that was living with a form of disability was Cobhams Asukwa. And though Cobhams is visual, I just put a call to him to say, how is your life living, you know, as a person with disability in Nigeria? And he was very candid and honest. And I explained to him what my reality was. And he told me point blank, it's not going to be easy, but will it be worth it? Absolutely. So I'm sitting here now, maybe in another hour, maybe an instance will pop in my head. But in the moment right now, I do not have any recollection of, you know, that one instance where it hit me that, okay, maybe when I was learning how to walk, you know, straight after amputation, they wanted to get into physical therapy. Oh, come and learn how to walk. It didn't even hit me as much as when I had to travel to the US to get my prosthetic limb. And I think that I remember very well my very first session with Anne. My physical therapies were so brutal and I wailed so badly because I was learning how to walk again. And then it hit me that, wait, you really do have one leg. I think that's the only instance that I recollect that addresses your question directly.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. Anu, are there any unique aspects to grieving process when it comes to loss of physical health or ability compared to other types of loss?
I think that when it comes to like processing grief, there's always the template of like dabda, but how it shows up with processing illness or loss of limb is unique. For one, when you are in denial, it will show up as like rejecting pain, rejecting the symptoms, rejecting the diagnosis, staying away from your loved ones, not disclosing. And sometimes with faith-based people, they may use their faith or religion to kind of mask their true emotions or feelings or even like acceptance of the diagnosis, right? So it will definitely like, it will be specific to like the loss of limb or chronic or the illness. With anger, it's like, why didn't I learn about this sooner? This doctor is lying. He wants to take advantage of me. Or they can turn it inwards, like, why didn't I take better care of myself? I was told not to do this if I had, you know, stuff like that. And then when you now get to like bargaining, it's like, what if you start bargaining with yourself? It's like, what if we do medication instead of doing this? What if we sleep? What if I start exercising now, or I change my diet now, or stuff like that, right? And then, as of course, depression was set in, the way we kind of can't separate grief from depression. Depression was set in and you start like processing like the new reality of yourself. And it gets more complicated if you've experienced other type of losses that is sort of like, you know, is stacked on it before you now get to the point of acceptance. And sometimes acceptance doesn't come by itself. You kind of need to have a support system or a professional to help you come to terms with what you're feeling, where you're just like, okay, I'm a person living with this chronic illness, I'm a person living with this disease or this disorder, and these are the next step, this is the first step that I have to take from it, even if you don't like it. So it's similar in the sense that like you might go through the ringer the same way other people will go through it, but how it shows up will be unique to that symptom, to that illness, living with a disability or living with an illness and so on. Yeah.
And as a clinical psychologist, what coping strategies do you recommend for someone who's grieving the loss of physical health or ability? Are there any particular therapeutic approaches or support system that has proven to be effective for individuals who are navigating this type of grief?
It depends on the type of grief that you're experiencing. If it's grief is more normal, it's grief is a normal reaction to the loss of anything. So in a normal situation, it's expected that you feel your feelings, that you move through it, that you get angry, that you take your time and you process it and so on. But where it gets wild is when it starts getting complicated, in the sense that rather than you moving through it and making sense of it, you start... I listened to a YouTube episode this morning where the person compared grief to like a wound, where in processing grief, normally you just sort of like salve it, you clean it up. It's painful, but you're just like taking care of it. And it's just like, oh, this is annoying, this is painful, but this is what I have to do today. But when it gets complicated, it's like rather than you taking care of it, you're like punching it or ignoring it and it gets infected. So in a situation like that, we'll say like grief is a normal reaction to things and you don't really fix grief. You just like move forward with grief. But when it gets complicated is when you're like invalidating your feelings. It's like, what does it mean that this loss of limb, that I'm disaffected by losing my limb, I'm a strong person? Or it is my fault that I experienced this. If I didn't go out that day, if I didn't get into that accident, if I didn't do this, if I didn't do that. And you start turning against yourself and you're not on your side while moving through this very difficult, challenging situation. So in that moment, I would say one, gets professional support. And professional support can look like group therapy. It can look like finding people that are experiencing the same thing that you're experiencing. Because sometimes when you're experiencing this sort of complicated grief, you expect your family to know what you're feeling, to know what to do, because they are the ones that know you. But the fact that they know you, it doesn't mean that they know the unique realities of what you are living with. And sometimes that may mean that they are not as equipped to help you. It might mean that they want to stay away because they feel like you need space. Meanwhile, that will make you feel disconnected or lonely. Meanwhile, you need connection. And sometimes it may mean that they are smothering you. Meanwhile, you need space to actually process what you're feeling and actually hear your voice, right? So it's very unique. So sometimes finding a group that would help you, that would want to validate your feelings, that would help you say like, this is annoying, this is complicated, this is, and just feel your feelings without bypassing it is a good start. And then two, it helps to like reframe your experience. And reframing the experience means that when you're downplaying the day-to-day aspects, when you're zooming in, you're downplaying the positives, when you're catastrophizing, when you're doing all of that, when you're looking at like the either or, I'm either someone with like a complete sense of abilities with nothing wrong with me, or I am damaged. That is a very polarized way of thinking. Sometimes it helps to restructure your thought process. And that's where like cognitive behavioral therapy may come in and so on. And generally, finding support means like building your resilience to the day-to-day things. Adenike talked about how when she meets a child, it is a unique experience to that child altogether. And I feel like in a situation like that, you are re-experiencing how different you are. And it may not be as wild as it was like 17 years ago or 10 years ago, but it's still showing that there's a gap between an imagined ideal self and the real self that you are feeling. And sometimes it takes a bit of resilience to accept that real self again and say, like, yes, today my real self looks this way, but my real self is also helping me swim, and I can drive, and I can walk, and I can read a book, and I can do all of these marvelous functional things. And I thank my body for the capacity to do all of these things. And sometimes the real self might just be like, yeah, it sucks that I am living with this reality, and that is okay, but you're not harming yourself and you're not dysfunctional. Both sides of the equation, they are both healthy, because you don't have to be positive every day, but you also don't have to turn against yourself every day. So like, those are the things that I would recommend, like validate your experience, find community, actually communicate to your family and your friends what you need. You might need space, but it doesn't mean, space doesn't have to mean disconnection or isolation. You might need community, but community doesn't have to be like you smothering yourself and so on. So yeah, that's kind of where I'll pause.
Thank you very much. That was very, very insightful. And the question I have for you, just as to hear from your own perspective, is as you ventured through your healing process, did you discover any unconventional coping strategies, right, that is not by the book, quote unquote? You know, as a person living with this type of personal experience, you know, sometimes we find this unconventional way of coping. So were there any unconventional coping strategies that you were even surprised at its effectiveness that you can walk us through and tell us about?
I think that whilst I was in the hospital, I did keep a journal, and I think that that helped me, especially in circumspect of releasing my first book about that whole journey. I didn't engage in any vices. I took God seriously. I had this neighbor who would always visit in the morning and evenings until I went to the hospital. You know, we would read the Psalms together. She would share me Bible verses. No one talked about therapy. No one talked about speaking to a therapist. I didn't even know that existed as an option. You know, I didn't know that was an option, speaking to a therapist. No one did any of that. So I really cannot place my fingers on how I coped, outside of knowing specifically that one of the things that was very loud for me that resonated was, I'm an only child. I needed to be strong. So I told myself I needed to be strong for my parents. That was what I told myself. But growing older now, I realized that they were even the ones that were stronger. You know, my parents were way stronger than I was, and I saw how well they took it, handled it. Yeah, we had a few issues here and there, to be honest with you, but overall, they were stronger. So there was no, I think that also, okay, one thing that comes to mind now is, by nature, helping people comes very easily to me. So one way I believe very strongly that I was able to navigate this reality was speaking to people casually. Oh, I know this person. Okay, can you speak to this person? Okay, no problem. Oh, there's someone here. Can we go and visit them? Are you sure? So I believe that lending a helping hand, literally paying it forward, was really a tool, and still is a tool, that has helped me navigate this reality, because now I'm able to even assess different permutations through the different experiences of others. Never once did I know what it meant to be visually impaired or have low vision or have or be low, you know, low hearing, or, you know, be an albino or be a dwarf. You know, I've never related with those realities because they were not mine until I started to broaden my horizon and then even work aggressively in this inclusion and disability space. And I think very strongly that that's what has been able to help me navigate this reality. Does it get to me often? Maybe not as often as it used to, because there's something called phantom pains where your brain tells your body that, oops, that, you know, the leg is still there, the leg is still there. So I want to scratch, I want to itch, I want to, in those moments, I'm like, kai, if I had my two legs now, I won't be dealing with this reality. But outside of that, nothing. I took God seriously. I dedicated my time and resources into God. I was in all the Bible classes. I was active in church. So yeah, I think that, yeah, those are the things that helped me.
Yeah, awesome. Anu said something earlier on about the role of family and loved ones when people are grieving, right? Sometimes it's like, since they, one would think they know you best, so they should know how to properly tend to you in those moments, right? But it's almost like the opposite, because they are not experiencing the same thing you're experiencing, and they've not been through that situation. So she talked about the importance of finding community of people who are going through that similar experience. But coming back to the family aspect, right? How can family and friends, you know, how can they, you know, help someone in this process? And what are some of the things that they should avoid saying or doing when somebody is going through this process of grieving from the loss of physical ability or health?
So I think that one of the first places to start from is, it was nothing you did.
Mm.
Because we live in Africa, there's a lot of
so powerful
cultural mystic connotation when things that are unexplainable happen. And cancer is a phenomenon. We don't know what caused it. We just know that certain cells in your body have started to grow abnormally. So it means that somebody is doing you. You have offended somebody. You wore somebody's shoes. Somebody put something on it. So the first place I would advise families to start from is to know that it has nothing to do with you. Now, secondly is, please keep a family history. Now, this is a very dicey point in the light of faith. And what do I mean? The Christian folks, we believe that generational illnesses cannot be repetitive by virtue of salvation, the blood of Jesus, and all of that. But we've now found out that those things do not have an impact if your lifestyle changes do not align with that reality. So case in point, somebody's grandmother dies fighting cancer. It skips the person's mom. The person now has cancer, right? The person has cancer, maybe dies. Now, it is clear that there have been two generations of cancerous experiences. So what ideally should happen, and don't forget, the type of cancer would even determine if it's more that is one that is predisposed to the female or not. If it's breast cancer, it means that for every female in that family, they must take their breast cancer screenings, they must very seriously. Now, the average Christian folk believes that, no, it can't happen. Faith of blood of Jesus, kinikon. Cancer feeds off of certain things. Is inflammation. If you are the sugar person, you know, there are several factors that add to it. If you do not make these lifestyle adjustments, the cancer will reoccur in another generation. So the second thing for me is family history. Please be very, very mindful of family history. Go and start to ask stories. Your uncle died, your father's uncle father died, his brother died. How? Was it pancreatic cancer? Was it colon? For me, in my own instance, the presupposition is that my maternal grandmother might have died from maybe anal or colorectal cancer. But because they did not have diagnosis, and what it means now is my uncle who lived in the US is the one that has now used his expertise and exposure to knowledge and science. And people, what they have now said is, it feels like your mom might have died from so and so. So it means that for me now, I need to be very careful in terms of lifestyle adjustment. There are certain things that people will take flippantly that I cannot. Number one is my yearly screenings. You must go and check your breasts as a woman yearly. You must check your colons. You must check your uterus. You must check these things yearly. And it goes to say for the other. So family history. The third one is possibly, I touched on it, lifestyle adjustments. You know, God is not a magician. Miracle and magic are two different things, you know. You can't be, our bodies are really literally the temple of God. And with nutrition, it also plays out that way. Commercialization, capitalism, and all of those theatrics, even government policies, many of it, do not necessarily want to nourish our bodies. Which is why every day we wake up, we see something else. Ah, it's not good. Ah, very soon, it's only air and water we'll be drinking. Even the water you drink, there are different types of water. You know, the first time I traveled and I was sitting for my meal, and they said, oh, well, do you want water? And they said, do you want sparkling? Do you want alkaline? Do you want like kilo shell? Give me water. you know, that's when you now find out that there are different types of water. You know, your nutrition cannot be overemphasized. You cannot be obese. You cannot have an obese child. You can't have a child today and think that your luxury or your affluence is how you bombard your child's lunchbox with biscuits, sweets, everything. No, we need to take a hold of our lives. And that's from nutrition, what we nourish our bodies with. Because it's what you nourish your bodies with that will give you a higher fighting chance. It doesn't mean that you do all of this and somebody, unfortunately, will not still have cancer. Because I know someone that did table to farm to table and still died fighting cancer. Guess what? There are many factors that add to it. So remember, you didn't do anything. Keep family history, lifestyle adjustments. And to be honest, what Anu said, community, a long bit of community, faith, and all of those are the factors that add and will just help you in on this journey. Does it make you feel scared sometimes? Yes, I'm going to be honest with you. You know, for women, for instance, when we are getting to our monthly menstrual cycle, our body is pesky. You know, so imagine you just hit your body somewhere and just, yay, God, hope it's not breast cancer. I'm being as honest as I possibly can. So much so that every time I've had to do a breast screening, I hold my breath until they are done screening. And what I had started to do, which I'm sure will never happen again after this year, is I rarely ever will tell the doctors that, oh, I lost my limb to cancer. So it's after they have checked, there's nothing wrong. I said, okay, great. Why? Oh, I lost my limb to cancer. Ideally, you're supposed to inform them of that so they know what to look out for if they are checking your screenings. So, and I say this as somebody who is always loud about it on social media. I've been making noise, shouting about even fibroids, PCOS, PCOD, insulin resistance. These are conversations, reproductive health conversations, holistically, that we do not know. Many of us don't even visit the gynecologist until you either find out you are pregnant or you have not seen your period. And those things are wrong. These things are things that we need to correct. And it goes to say for men as well, which is why things like HPV are vaccines that, you know, intentional parents must start to give their children once they hit certain stages. You don't wait till your child is 18, whether female or male, to start to expose them to all of these things. And I believe very strongly that with some of these things and a lot of other things that people say, and God is the one that gives you inspiration. It says that the spirit in man, inspiration comes from God Almighty. It's God that will give you the inspiration to, is this, why don't you mix this and this together to create, you know, recipes that would work for you. Because if you continue to look at the world, every day you wake up, you say, don't eat this one, don't eat that one, don't eat this one. There's so much you can do. And you need to also tell yourself that you will only try your best and just leave the rest to God, because you cannot completely take everything in. Toxins in our perfumes, in our body sprays, in our hair products, in our skincare products, in the things that we eat, in our mobile devices, laptops, it is endless. So you just have high blood pressure if you want to cut everything out. You cannot cut everything out. This is just make sure that as much as you can, you are feeding your body with the rawest, purest, as well I'm hoping you can get. Because even getting sourcing organic stuff, girl, that one, girl, is another conversation on its own. So I feel like from my own experience, so from 17 years ago up until now, these are things that I wish that I was armed with, things that I wish that I knew, you know. Things like vegetable oil. First, I saw it on social media, vegetable oil is not good. I say people have come. By the time I sat down, I thought, they're actually not safe. All the canola, can it come? I'm like, wait, what? You know, I'm like, wait, what? You know, I started to say, okay, so you mean that olive oil, you mean coconut oil, you mean this? And I'm like, what the bottom line really is, moderation. I'm not saying don't take sugar. I have chocolate in my house at the moment, but you know that you have to do everything in moderation. Otherwise, you go overboard. You can't have an obese child and expect that when the child becomes a teenager, the child is able to adjust their weight. Those things start from those ages. What conversations are you having with your partner, or the person you have a child with, or your spouse, whatever it is, wherever it is that you are? What kind of conversations are you having? I never went to a gynecologist. Never. I never went to a gynecologist. First time I wanted to see a gynecologist was first they found out I had fibroids. So imagine how, and every year I used to do yearly checks. So one can only just hope and pray that everything pans out well. And my final point will really be, don't live in fear. It's very easy to live in fear. you cannot afford to live in fear, because once you live in fear, it increases your stress level. It increases many, many chemicals in your body that I do not know. And that has such a diverse impact on you. It affects your sleep. If you can live in a place outside of Lagos, please do, so that you'll not be waking up at 4 a.m. and getting back at 11. Honestly speaking, you are laughing, because these things are famous. I'm not interested. When I started to pay attention to the pimple I was having, was when the woman broke down the extent of what trafficking and stress does to our whole bodies, inclusive of our health.
Yeah.
And finally, please make sure you pay attention to your gut. In fact, majority of what happens in your body externally starts from your gut. What do you feed your gut? Make sure you pay rapt attention to what it is you feed your body overall. So yeah, that's with these few points of mine.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that. I want to piggyback on some of the things you said. Firstly, you talked about no one told you about therapy. That wasn't something you knew about at all. And you also said something about visiting the gynecologist, about no one told you about that too. And that's something you've started doing. Some individuals might be hesitant to seek professional help or support, right? And this is the constant arms race that we're battling, especially in this space when we're talking about mental health, life challenges and struggles, right? People don't see the importance of it. Like our culture and how we've been raised, that's not been something that has been said to us or taught to us. We thank God for the newer generation and how they are open about these issues. Just to draw back some of the importance of therapy, for example, this is the first time you're speaking to Anu, and she puts it on a professional hat, and she said something about maybe accepting that situation as a gift earlier on in this conversation. And you were like, you've never thought about it from that perspective before. And this is the importance of therapy. This is the importance of seeking professional help, of helping us to understand exactly where we are, make sense of the situation so we can move forward in a positive way. So to individuals who are hesitant, right, of seeking professional help in any way, whether it be their physical health, their mental health, emotional health, or other aspects of their life, how can we encourage those individuals? What would we say to them to better help them understand the importance of doing these things and how we can make tremendous changes in their life? I think I will go first with Adenike, and then we'll come to Anu so that she can.
I think that for me, I'm a realist, and I like to put realistic scenarios. I don't know if you know Kiki Palmer. So Kiki Palmer grew up watching her Akila and the Spelling Bee and all of that. And then she's had a son and she has a boyfriend. And then she went to watch Usher in Las Vegas a few days ago. Why the story hit me is because on my social media, I've been saying, you guys, I need to go and watch Usher. I need to watch Usher. You know, and she wore a see-through outfit. And apparently her boyfriend was displeased about it and decided to go on Twitter to address it, right? And I think he went haywire. People started to drag him, blah, blah, blah. And now they're saying that both of them are unfollowed each other. I don't know how true it is. I cite this example because my friend was just telling me that blah, 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 blah. And I told her, I said, when you are in a genuine relationship with someone is when you will know how far you can be stretched. I said, I'm just 3 years in marriage by December. And I'm like, when people ask me how married life has been, I always say revelatory. It has been revelatory to myself. It has been revelatory to my partner. It has been revelatory to both of us together. There are things that I have said and I have done that never in my life would I have thought, oh, wow, that was you, and vice versa. And I told her that, look, we have a cancel culture, and sometimes we don't even know how bad it is, because I wonder how somebody in Fagba, in Lagos, is telling Kiki Palmer on social media that she should leave her boyfriend because he corrected her on social media. And without a doubt, again, for me, that's an example of how much all of us need therapy, because therapy is not until you have a mental breakdown. It's just to live a better quality of life, basically. And until I sat in front of a therapist, I didn't know how much, I don't want to say trauma because it's a word that, you know, everybody likes to toss around, but I didn't know how much help that I needed. And for me, it's like driving a car. you will need to service your car. You will need to take out the oil filter, sometimes the fuel filter, so that the car moves smoother, faster, and seamlessly. And I think that for me, that is what therapy does. It oils you and gives your car better performance and functioning. Therapy is not connotative of having issues, because we always see it when there's a like an emotional breakdown on social media and everybody goes, I should go for therapy, she should go for therapy. There was also a young man who trended, I think a day or two ago, that said if everybody he's ever dated in the time past should please forgive him, that he has now done therapy and he sees that he was toxic. That is what therapy does. Therapy is like Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror. Sits you in front of the mirror and shows you exactly who it is that you are. And except you are unwilling, you know, to becoming a better person, you will never understand the implication of what it is. It was through therapy that I realized that I needed to throw away my superwoman cloak. I needed to throw it away. I needed to stop being everything to everyone and nothing to myself. It was through therapy that I needed to understand that I wasn't extending as much grace to the person I was with as I expected that I should receive in return. It was through therapy that I'm able to now understand that with the disability discourse and this life journey now, when you reach out to me, I saw somebody, I'm able to tell you categorically, where I am now mentally, I do not believe I can be productive to this person. And I'm so sorry that you're reaching me at such a time. I will not be able to take on this project. Before, even when I couldn't take up the project, I wasn't vocal enough to productively tell you that this thing you are saying, the way this thing is burning in your heart, the understanding of passion and purpose and God that I know is this assignment is yours and not primarily mine. You know, these are the things that therapy has helped me to do. And I have a friend who's a therapist who we both have indirect and informal sessions every now and then. And I see that it gives me a better quality of life, first for myself. I'm that person that believes that nobody changes for anyone. You will have to change first for yourself before you can change for someone else. And in our home, when we pray, for instance, we say something, let me be a better person first for myself. If I'm not a better person for myself, I can't give. There's something in law. I can't give what I don't have. And because I don't have it for myself first, I can't expend it to the person I'm with. And I see it play out almost all the time. So I'm very certain that from experience, I've been able to tell you that therapy without a doubt is one of the best decisions you can ever make. There's a connotation about being expensive on the outside, but as with food, you can buy food from the roadside, you can buy food from restaurants, and there are different types of restaurants. You can buy food from the very, very bougie places. I believe very strongly that that is how therapy also is. If you start from the roadside therapy and you're lucky to have a person who knows what it is that they're doing, they start you off on a journey. You see the impact that it's having on your life. And guess what? You make sure that you provide resources to aspire to get into another person who can give you the better quality of what you think you deserve. There are people who charge in naira, there are people who charge in dollars. My auntie pays for therapy in pounds. She lives in Nigeria. And I know how much she has spent in the last 1 year. You do not want to know what it is she has had to spend. But guess what has happened? She's living a better quality of life for herself as well as for her partner in her marriage and with all of her children. So therapy is not for sick people. Therapy is only to oil the engine of your car so that you can get the optimal performance of what your car can do. Thank you.
I don't know what you want me to add to that, but like, I agree. I love it. I love it. I love hearing how it has impacted you and all the scenarios that you shared. And yes, yes. So what she said, basically, what's wrong with that?
I heard what she said and I agree with it. So I think something we should emphasize on is self-acceptance and self-compassion, because I think most of the things you said, talking about how therapy has made you realize that you can't give what you don't have and you are important, you are valid. Even if you want to take care of other people's needs, you should also come first. I think it's the same thing with people. People would say, why should I go to therapy, for example, now? Is the fact that as much as we have a relationship with ourselves, so many of us go through life without being compassionate to ourselves, right? It's like somebody might say, you are going, the work you are doing is too much. And you'll be like, no, don't worry, I know myself or whatever. Like, it's not too much for me, right? People don't understand that self-compassion is like we, our loved ones, we're able to show love, care, and attention to them better than we, you know, have for ourselves. So, maybe I know you should speak to, the importance of self-acceptance and self-compassion and how it plays a role in even helping when we're, when somebody's going through, grieving from this type of, loss of a physical ability or health, and how that can help them better, navigate that process, basically.
I always define compassion as noticing pain and responding with kindness. And I think that a lot of times we struggle with self-compassion because the template that we've given ourselves is we have a structure of responding to flaws with punishments rather than consequences. We have a structure of seeing that, oh, I did something wrong. I was imperfect here. Therefore, I must punish myself here. And if you're going to like trace that back, we are going to see how you misplaced your book, Five Strokes of the Cane. You did this. You didn't do your assignment. Orodurapata. You're the last person on the, you carried last, so to speak. And they're like pointing you out and so on. So we've grown up in a culture of labeling, of name calling. And not necessarily a culture of problem solving, of collaboration, of checking in to see, hey, what was it that happened here? Why were you struggling with math? We just assume that some people are good at math and some people are not good at math, because some people are serious and some people are not serious. Or something as little as at home, a glass is broken. And it's like, you're so careless. You always run up and down, rather than what were you looking for? How can I help you? Were you hurt? Are you okay? I noticed that like this is the third glass that you have broken. How can we make, you know, this place safer for you? How can you be a bit more careful? It hurts my feelings when you break these plates. Can we do these things differently? The idea is a lot when you grow up in a culture where compassion isn't the first point of call, when compassion and checking in and collaboration and so on isn't the go-to. You don't suddenly become an adult with the tools to show yourself compassion. You immediately punish yourself as you were punished. You immediately label yourself as you were labeled. You immediately name call yourself as you were name called because you were not taught to do that. You don't have that culture of doing that. So when I speak to clients, when we start doing like self-compassion work, they struggle with doing that, not because they don't see the impact of showing themselves compassion, but because they see it as letting themselves off the hook. They see like, am I spoiling myself? Does that mean that I am going to be indisciplined and I will still be stuck here? And it's like, no, it just means that you're taking not necessarily the easier way to go, but a softer way to go to get to the goals that you want. Because if you're going to keep labeling yourself, you're still going to label yourself as the unserious one, as the weak one, and the soft one, and so on, and still be stuck at where you are. Same with acceptance. Acceptance just means like you're noticing the situation and you're accepting it like, this is what is happening here. You're not trying to what if, maybe, coulda, shoulda, woulda. You're just like, this is the reality of what I'm experiencing. What do I need to do next? But because like acceptance cannot be done without compassion, we move through situations by disconnecting. We move through situations by disengaging, by, you know, by avoiding the situation. Because like accepting the situation may mean accepting the role that you played in it sometimes. Accepting the situation may mean accepting like the new story that you have to tell about yourself. Accepting the situation may mean that you're a step away from the ideal you that you imagine yourself to be. You're accepting like a self that is not, you know, as close to your fantasy self as you would have liked. And that may be difficult to navigate if you don't show yourself compassion, if you don't have the practice of giving yourself grace. So to start with, when you're doing self-compassion work, like you said, it's easier to show other people compassion than it is to show yourself compassion because you're outside their body. You can empathize with them. You can sit with them and you're not sitting through all the traumas and the stories that they are telling themselves. It's very easy to give them grace. So imagine that your friend were in that situation. Your friend did all the things that you did. Your friend is feeling all the pain that you're feeling. What do you want your friend to know in that regard? What do you want your friend to realize in that regard? Adenike earlier said that the first thing that your family needs to tell you is that it's not your fault. And that's such a strong thing to remember, because like that denial, that anger, everything may be turned inwards and you start attacking yourself. So if it's very easy for you to tell your friend that it is not your fault, how can you build that practice of telling yourself that? How can you call yourself your friend? Even if you don't immediately believe it, how can you speak to yourself like you would a friend? Sometimes it may mean like really sitting in front of an empty chair and like imagining anybody sitting there and talking to that person like it wasn't you. And then at the end of the day, imagine yourself sitting there. Or say, dear dash, write a note to that person. And then at the end, write your name at the top of that letter, meaning that you're writing to yourself. So there are many ways to build that practice. And at the beginning, to be awkward, it will mean that you're kind of letting yourself off the hook, or you're treating yourself with kid gloves and so on. But it is a muscle that is worth building. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. As we round up the conversation, right, Adenike, looking back at your journey, right, what would you say has been the most significant lesson you've learned from embracing resilience and also navigating life after loss?
Most profound journey still till today is the power of community. There's a saying in Yoruba that goes like, "Iniyolashomi, I have stood through storms, through floodings, through drought, and still standing because of community. I am community, and for that reason, I enjoy community. I'm one of the most loyal persons you would ever encounter in your life, and I say that without any glitch or pride. It's such a tool that the Holy Spirit has empowered me with, and because of that, it comes very easily to me when I'm open to people around me to feel covered, to be carried, you know. And I say often to people that unfortunately and sadly, some people do not have these stories because they have real life stories of being treated badly or backbiting or bad experiences. But I remember a few years ago when I woke up and I told God I want a community, and that was all I dedicated my prayer life to. For a very long time, I kept praying about community. So today, when I enjoy it, I know that those were seeds that were sown. And the Bible says that cast your bread upon many waters. Many. You know, when Anouk defined compassion, she said, you see pain and you respond with kindness. My goodness, that's one of the most profound things I've ever heard. I see that that is what has continued to push me. You know, community, kindness, loyalty, God, dedication, accountability. All of these things are nothing. You know, no matter how resilient I might seem to the world, I'm resilient because some people have covered me in the place of prayer when I have said, you guys, I can't pray. I want to give up. You know, there's something, there's a project we're working on. And 2 days ago, my friend called me. I was just speaking into my spirit and saying, you can't give up. She said, you know, many times I'll let you give up. You were showing up in my house and calling me and telling me, you cannot, you are joking. She said, go and sleep. Tomorrow when we wake up, we will re-strategize. And it was in that moment I broke down in hot tears. So honestly speaking, community has been my largest and biggest flex. Not a husband, you know, not a family, not father or mother, but community, collectively. And I remember my husband say to me, I don't even know where do you meet these people from? And I'm like, even me, I don't know. So, take your time. One person at a time. You've been hurt, you've been broken, you've been backstabbed, I get it. But wake up one day and say, this fire no more. Just be yourself, honestly speaking. I will let you go if you mess up. I will love you from far. that was something I also had to learn, because I'm that one that always likes to see benefit of doubt, until the benefit of doubt almost puts me in trouble, you know. So I will love you from far. I don't cut you off like we say colloquially on social media. I would not give you access again. You had access and you messed it up on several occasions, by the way, you know, but I will love you from far. And we might still be community, but we might not be as close as we once were. But should you need my help at any point in time, if I'm able to, best believe I'll give it to you. So yeah, thank you very much.
So before we round up, where can listeners actually find information, resources, or support on this particular topic? If they want more, like when it comes to, I know you have a foundation at Denike. Can you speak on that and the usefulness of it for people going through this situation?
So Beauty's United initiative is primarily what I had mentioned earlier about me speaking, helping. So it's basically creating a safe haven. And, you know, the dream, the goal, the hope, the everything is that you have somebody who holds your hand as you go through your journey to say, I got you, you know, I'm here. And it was born from a personal space where I needed to be handheld. And I got the handholding, but I didn't get it through the means. I wanted people in the disability space, people who are living this disability, to hold my hand. And so follow social media. I have a book that recounts my, you know, journey from that time up until 2019 when I wrote it. I'm working on another book, and it's from 2019 to when I am, or whenever it is the book comes out. And Twitter at Denike Oyetunde, social media, Instagram at Denike Oyetunde, Facebook, LinkedIn, yada yada yada. I have a gratitude page called the Gratitude Haven, and the primarily assignment, I beg your pardon, is for people to be reminded consistently that truly, truly, in all things, give thanks. You know, I can be crying from hurt, oh my God, all this. And, you know, after all of that has passed, I'm like, God, everything works together for my good. I can't see it now. I don't know. But I will give thanks in everything, because it wasn't a suggestion that was made to me by Paul. He was inspired by the Holy Spirit. And when you read his life's journey as to what he had just been through and what he was about to face when he said, in all things, give thanks, you will just say, you know, I think it was speaking to the Thessalonians, you know, all things, give thanks, or Philippians, I'm not sure now, you know. And for me, that is my life's goal, to show the world that gratitude is such a powerful tool that rewires your brain. Like you find yourself in a challenge and you are thinking of way out, like, okay, how do we go? Not that, who did me, who did not do, who did I do? My father's side, my mother's side. I am on the Lord's side, and that's all that matters. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I know we didn't get to the part of the advocacy work and all the initiative you're putting forward and your fight in this the space of making, creating access for people with disability. Maybe hopefully in the future that can be like a different episode that we can do to talk about all the things you've been doing and you keep doing. I listened to your TED talk about anyone can become a philanthropist. That was really one of the most powerful.
I'm impressed.
It's our work, it's my job. I think I really would like to have like a conversation with you about that. Anyone can become a philanthropist, to put the sense of, how would I put it? Urgency in everyone to know that they can actually make positive changes in their environment and in society. And they don't have to have all the resources available to them. You know, just that one post, that one call, like you rightly said, can make a huge difference. You even talked about somebody donating blood to you that you're meeting for the first time and how that has impacts your life and everything. So moving forward, Anu also, please, before we round up, can you please maybe share some information, how people can reach out to you and, you know, people who need your assistance? And where can people find you on social media? Because you put out amazing content to every day, almost every day, actually, that are very, very helpful to people. So how can people actually reach you?
So if to schedule a session, you can just visit ustherapy.org. That's ustherapy.org. And social media, ustherapy on Instagram and TikTok and on Twitter by ustherapy.
Yeah, like always, I'll leave links to all of these things that you've mentioned, links to everything to be on the description, actually, and people can easily just click on them and find them. So once again, I'd like to say thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation. I truly, truly appreciate all of you and the both of you for coming. Yeah, nice. People, you too, you should follow her. People listening, follow her too, please. Thank you. I really, really appreciate you guys. And hopefully we can do this sometime again in the future. And at any case, please, I would like you to take me up on that offer for any time you feel we can actually have that conversation. I'm really, really willing to dive deep into that. So thank you very much, guys. And
thank you so much for having me. Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you so much, Anu, for your calm demeanor. I do appreciate it. Thank you so much, Tony. To have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you very much for listening to this conversation. To support this podcast, please like, share, leave a comment or a review, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Piers_Arena. Thank you once more.